Welcome to the Echo Chamber Club podcast. Welcome to the Echo Chamber Club podcast. Here we discuss what key thinkers, values and beliefs are and try and unpack these ideas for 2017. How do they want to see society function and what are their dreams for the future? I'm Alice Thwaite, I'm the founder and editor of the Echo Chamber Club, and with me today we've got a very exciting guest. I'm with award-winning journalist, historian and philosopher Rennie Edo-Lodge. Rennie has written a groundbreaking book called Why I'm No Longer Talking to White People About Race. And here she is with us today. Welcome, Rennie.
Hello, thanks for having me.
No, it's a real pleasure. I absolutely love the book and I think that our readers should definitely go out and buy it and read it.
Fabulous, thanks for the plug.
Yeah, no problem. But because it's really good to talk about values, and I know that you've got a lot of very interesting beliefs, some that you thought about an awful lot, and I'd really like to unpack what these ideas are. To start off with talking about your vision for society, so your book is about the cultural pervasiveness of racism, and I also know that in an interview a couple of years ago you spoke about feminists not aiming for equality as such but for liberation. And I don't suppose you could just expand on the society that you dream of, that you work towards and you aim for.
Sure. So, I suppose people talk a lot about equality of opportunity, and I see structural discrimination, structural racism, structural sexism as a huge impeder of equality of opportunity. When I talk about liberation, I guess I'm talking about the ways about taking away those things that impede equality of opportunity, you know. I think it's as simple as that, really. And for some reason, in recent years, people have started to dismiss politics like mine as identity politics. But I think that's a gross misrepresentation of the points that at least I'm trying to make, which is, you know, the facts are, you know, in this country, I wrote in the book, you know, I knitted together statistical data from basically pretty credible sources, you know, census data, Department for Education, the DWP, Department for Work and Pensions, which collates information on the state of our nation and collates racial data. So not exactly wildly biased, wildly biased sources, but, you know, it's telling me that, you know, a black boy in particular is three times more likely to be excluded from school than the rest of the school population, that black kids are sort of undermarked by their own teachers when they're taking their year six SATs, and that's something that's actually rectified by anonymous marking. You know, we know that black kids are more likely to get into higher education, but they're less likely than their white counterparts to get into the best universities. That they're overrepresented in the like lowest degree rankings. That even if they do get a job, they're much more likely to be unemployed than their white counterparts. And then if they are applying for jobs, people with African and Asian sounding names are called to interview much less rate than people with white sounding names. That's a stat from the DWP. So not exactly like it's not coming from Black Lives Matter, you know. We know that the Trade Union Congress did some research a couple of years ago that basically found out that there's a consistent wage gap between BMA people and white people, and it's one that actually widens with increased qualifications. And we also know that people who are not white actually get harsher treatment within the criminal justice system for possession of drugs, even though white people are much more likely to use drugs. And there's also, there was an NHS inquiry done maybe about 12 years ago now after a black man, David Bennett, died in a psychiatric unit that basically showed, the inquiry showed that black people were much more likely to be perceived to be aggressive and to be psychotic and to be sectioned. And these are all things that we, as human beings in this society, can't exactly avoid. Like, we all need to go to school, you know, we all need to take exams, you know, we want to go to university, that should be a right that we can all take, right? Like, we all need to get a job, like, and we all come into contact with the NHS and policing and the criminal justice system at some point in our lives. Like, these are touchstone institutions to which we should all expect equal treatment, but the big picture has shown that that's not the case. And I think that something that I've been increasingly frustrated by is the fact that we are sort of told that the best way to be progressive in society is to be totally colorblind. But clearly there's huge systemic problems here. And I see those systemic problems as an absolute infringement on equality of opportunity, because clearly the huge data is telling us that equality of opportunity and meritocracy does not exist. And I think that, you know, some people have thought that if we don't talk about race, then the problem will go away, but it's clearly much, much deeper than that. So I think that's what I shape my politics around.
And yeah, that's a really, well, yeah, great unpacking of the problem. I suppose what the issue is as well is just how difficult it is to take away these kind of cultural, cultural racism, basically. How can society work to liberate itself from these prejudices and injustices? You mentioned anonymous marking when you were speaking there. Are there... What else can we work towards? What can we aim for?
Well, I think the usual solution posed to any organisation or industry that has its structural racism exposed like this. And I think what's really important to say is that in all of these sort of like touchstone organisations, you know, NHS, the NHS, schooling and higher education institutions, they're not exactly headed up by a frothing, you know, out and out proud to be racist people, are they, you know? And one thing that is a phrase that we hear a lot in Britain is so-and-so hasn't got a racist bone in their body. But I honestly think that just because you believe that you don't have a racist bone in your body doesn't mean that you suddenly opt out of reproducing racism, right? I think that we're all sort of born into sort of almost already written scripts about what to expect from people because of their race. And that is something that basically infects the fabric of our society. And so I think a lot of people are resistant to that, which, I mean, some might call it an idea, but I think that this data shows that it's frankly a fact. But for those who aren't resistant to it, often people basically pose positive discrimination solutions. You know, like that often happens in like workplaces, so places that are hiring people, institutions that hire people, sectors, industries, etc., etc. And I know for a fact that I wouldn't have a career if it wasn't for a positive discrimination scheme. I talk about that in the book. It gave me access to journalism institutions that I had no access to prior. That's just the case. I don't know how I feel about representation for representation's sake, but I think that it's one way, because we've had a good few hundred years of positive discrimination already, but it's been unofficial.
Sure. And one thing that I actually really did think about when I was reading the book is this idea about the fact that it is almost the case that everyone has this kind of racist attitude within them, but it's very, you can't own up to that because that's kind of culturally a big no-no, right? So perhaps about reframing what it means to be racist. Do you see what I mean?
Well, I mean, sorry to interrupt, but I think, you know, the way that we framed racism thus far, or I don't know about we, I know I haven't been doing it, but let's say the dominant understanding is about really bad, evil people, terrible people. And that's why I think that it's so, being called racist, and I talk about this a lot in the book, that, you know, being called racist or even being being perceived, I think, for a white person in particular, to be considered racist is like seen as a huge personal attack. It's terrible. Actually, worse than actual racism. Like,
yeah, I agree.
So that's why people call racism a slur or whatnot. But I don't actually think that it's about good or bad people. I don't think it's about morals. Now, there's certainly people who, for a very long time, have used racism as a political campaigning tool, and I doubt their morals. But ultimately, I don't think it's about morals. It is about structural discrimination. And I think that's why the first chapter of the book is dedicated to Britain's relationship with race thus far, and history in particular. And it's nice that you called me a historian at the beginning, but I'm really not. But I did go and go through like lots of archive sources in order to sort of like tease out these stories, because Britain in particular has always had a very tortured and difficult relationship with racism, and is not very forthcoming about being honest with that. Like, of course that is going to affect everybody's psyche in the entire country, you know? So, like, it's absolutely normal and natural that everyone is going to have some racial bias, I think, regardless of your race. But because, you know, I think it's been a win and a sort of a loss of past anti-racism campaigning, that one thing that was really, really successful was that it made it clear that racism was unacceptable and a very bad thing. And I think that wider white society heard anti-racist campaigners, you know, 30 years ago, said, okay, yeah, we agree with you, racism is very bad. But wider white society didn't actually ruminate about how racism really works, you know. It sort of took the definition as racism is discriminating against somebody because of the colour of their skin. Right, don't do that. So the best thing to do is just to not talk about it and stop. Like, there was no real keenness to actually, like, take up the actual meat of the issue or look at this country's complicity in it, you know. So, yeah, it's absolutely normal that loads of people are going to have racial bias and anti-blackness. That me saying that it's normal isn't me saying that's great. No, because I think that the indicator of a society's like progress is its willingness to challenge that and be self-critical. And I've been lucky enough to travel quite a bit because of my work. And I find, you know, it's in places like in Germany or the US, it's a much more open and honest conversation about country's role in discrimination in the past and its legacy. We don't have those sorts of conversations.
No, I agree, and I spent half my time in Berlin as well, and it's very noticeable just how different the cultural attitude is towards their history compared to in Britain, because I guess we won the war, right? So we liberated the world from the Nazis. I think that's also something you might bring up in your book as well. And it's very true that Germans kind of bring up the Holocaust and bring up their history, and they want to talk about it, but they do not want to joke about it. It's something that they understand they're kind of complicit in. It's a very different response to these issues. But one thing I did want to speak to you about was this idea about education and about cultural education, because I think it's something that we talk about a lot. We talk about how important it is for younger generations to understand where we've come from, to learn about Henry VIII, to learn about the Second World War, these kind of topics that are key in, definitely were key in my childhood syllabus. What does education mean to you? What kind of what do you want to see on the curriculum? What do you want to see as part of our cultural education?
I think a very good starting point would be Black History Month. When I was at school, I haven't been in school for a long time now, but Black History Month was dedicated to the wins of you know, Black Americans, African Americans, essentially. You know, I learned about Rosa Parks, I learned about Harriet Tubman and the Underground Railroad, and I learned about Martin Luther King Jr. Okay, great, good. But, and I carried on life thinking, wow, those people were great, but that's not relevant to me. You know, I live in East London. I was raised in South London. So, but what I didn't know was that there was basically an identical Rosa Parks situation happening in Bristol, you know, where there was basically a colour bar on Britain's buses in the 60s. And the bus company had had an agreement with the trade union not to hire any black people, you know. And there was a bus boycott that loads of people in the city stuck to. They walked and cycled around the city rather than getting the buses until the bus company backed down. And that happened around the same time that Martin Luther King was making his I Have a Dream speech. I didn't know, for example, about Dr. Harold Moody and the League of Coloured Peoples. You know, people call, historians have called Dr. Harold Moody Britain's Martin Luther King, basically. When he was advocating for basically race equality in the early 20th century. For some reason, we talk about black and brown people in this country as recent immigrants, when actually, like, black and brown people have been absolutely integral into making the country what it is now. Not only that, but, and that's usually because we've come from former Commonwealth countries, right? So, like, countries that were literally owned by Britain until very recently. Despite that, they've been treated disgustingly by the British state, and yet there's still this like enduring loyalty. You know, I'm Nigerian, and there's still a lot of loyalty to Britishness and British culture, and I think that we would have a very different country and a very different understanding of race and racism in Britain if we had those things on the curriculum, which we don't. In my research, I found that local authorities, national curriculums, so like in Bristol or in like Southeast London, where Dr. Harold Moody was doing his initial work, they were pretty good at honouring their local heroes. But these people weren't considered national heroes in the same way they are, say, in the US.
So quickly on that, because when you talk about something like Black History Month, I mean, that to me just makes me think, okay, so we spend 1/12 of our lives then perhaps being exposed to this kind of history, right? You think about how many dramas exist about the Tudors still in comparison to what you've just said. I just also wonder about how and whether or not you've got any plans to expose this kind of history to people who perhaps don't want to turn up to Black History Month events, because essentially that's kind of an opt-in type thing. And yes, we could talk about education of children, but also just educating adults. How do you get this type of history onto, you know, BBC One, for instance? How do we make this as crucial to our identity as perhaps something like, I mean, I bring up the Tudors, but just only because I think that we do a new historical program on the Tudors every 6 months. Is there something that you've got plans for there, or is it something that you think Black History Month is doing pretty well at the moment?
Well, I don't have any plans myself, but I would always point people towards David Olusoga's work. I mean, he's been doing a couple of Black and British documentaries on the BBC for the last couple of years now, and they're really useful, really informative. He did one about Britain's role in the slave trade. You know, I think there's this discussion about the slave trade that talks about how, like, it was really bad that America did that, and look at the legacy that it's having in American life today. But it was transatlantic for a reason. Like, Liverpool was one of them. Liverpool, Bristol, London, like, a lot of our big cities were involved in that. And actually, a lot of British countries are, a lot of British cities are actually built on the wealth. Particularly Liverpool and Bristol. In fact, in Bristol now, they're having a debate about whether or not to keep a building named after a slave trader, right? So he did a documentary about that, and he's been doing other ones, and I think he's got a book out at the moment. So that's like your super duper clearly accessible stuff that I would always refer people to, and I think he's got a book out as well, and he's an actual historian, so...
Okay, yeah. I when I was reading your book, I did just think that you've put a lot of work into the history, which is why I called you a historian.
Right. Maybe I'm doing myself down there.
I think you might be doing yourself down a little bit, yeah, because I think it's kind of crucial to you to make sure that you've got the historical evidence. But
typical imposter syndrome.
Perhaps, but we all have it, especially when we're in our 20s, right? So there was something else, because there's a key part which just opened my eyes slightly. And I suppose there's this narrative that's being pushed at the moment, which is this whole idea of the metropolitan elite kind of being blind to what the working class want and the realities of living in this country at the moment. There's a part in your book when you're talking about intersectional feminism, and you're talking about the way that the New Statesman, which is this centre-left publication here in the UK, was very much anti-intersectional feminism, anti this idea of the fact that there might be different types of feminism for black people and for white people, for instance. And when I was reading about this, and you were talking about this happening from 2012 and through to 2014, it struck me that you might have a different interpretation of the way that the media has been portraying cultural life in the UK. You might not think that it's been pushing ever more leftwards. Instead, you might think it's been pushing ever more rightwards. Is that a correct analysis of what you might think? And if so, why do we have this pervasive notion that the metropolitan elite is just pushing ever more to the left? What's your take on all those different points?
Pushing more to the left? Well, I don't know. I mean, I wrote that bit about the New Statesman because what was happening at the time was that there were people like myself who were basically saying over and over again, you know, I started out as a feminist activist, so that's something that I was involved with in university and carried on being involved in, you know, straight after graduation. And while I was involved in feminist activism, I was also saying, like, feminism needs an anti-racist perspective, but because not all women are white, like, so we're going to be talking about basically structural things that impede women's equality of opportunity. We need to be talking about racism as well, and other things, other essentially structural things that are holding people back from their full potential, right? That's how I've always seen it. And I basically was completely shut down, as I write about in the book, by white women who had quite large platforms in the media. And I was sort of told that I was being angry, aggressive and divisive, and sometimes was even called a bully. But it wasn't ever directly at me. It was towards the end, but at the beginning, it was really quite op-eds in the New Statesman in particular. And I actually went back in the book and like just quoted verbatim from a lot of them that were being published. And it was about the ideas that people like me were putting forward, which was when I was saying essentially like we need an anti-racist perspective in feminism. And here are the women who've said it before, women in the 80s mostly, but beforehand, you know, women in the 60s were also saying these sorts of things, mostly black women. And we were being told by New Statesman writers in particular that this is jargon, this was nonsense, this was divisive. To me, it's nonsensical that a movement that claims to work on behalf of all women would ignore this. It's just nonsensical, right? So I then sort of was able to trace what was being published there and how it sort of found the same sentiment was essentially being repeated in much more right-wing outlets and ultimately the alt-right, you know? So it was actually like a super-duper deeply conservative backlash against some of the points that I was making back in 2012 and 2013, and it ended up in like these super-duper ultra-conservative and sometimes quite white supremacist outlets. But I saw that backlash start in the New Statesman. And so I guess my, you know, I think when I was putting forward those arguments, like I was an unemployed graduate, pretty much. Like I was freelancing, but not really earning enough money to live. And I was just sort of like writing on the internet. I wasn't really much of a threat, you know, a black girl from Tottenham. But it was really, really received as a big threat to people who I suppose we would now call the metropolitan liberal elite. And that was really strange to me because I think that, you know, my parents were Guardian readers when I was growing up. And you would sort of think that a publication like that would be on your side. But I guess evidently not. Maybe I'm jaded now. I don't know. But I suppose, in answer to your question, I think that, like, black women who are writing about race on the internet and also feminist writers, probably from about 2010, were really the canary in the coal mine to some of the politics that we are seeing today, because we've been talking about this for quite some time now. And then 2016 happened, and then a bunch of other people were like, oh gosh, this is really bad, isn't it? I'm so shocked. And I was like, but I'm not actually shocked. I'm really not shocked, you know? And I think that what's been happening more broadly is that people outside of, you know, groups who have access to Opine and the New Statesman have been feeling increasingly frustrated and have been trying to talk about things and are being slapped down, you know. And I can kind of understand. I think I can understand why people are deeply frustrated. Now, am I in the position to complain? Not really anymore. I mean, I've since had the opportunity to write a book about that situation. But other people would take their revenge in the ballot box, I suppose.
Yeah, it's interesting to get your perspective on that. This might be quite a difficult question to answer, and it is, I suppose, slightly provocative. But you must be expecting some sort of criticism after the publication of this book, right? Like, it's provocative. What kind of criticism are you expecting, and how would you counter that? So to kind of, you know, predict it in the before it even happens.
Well, it's not published yet. It's published in about a week's time, and people are already getting themselves into a tizz. One thing that really interests me is about sort of like the power of ideas, because it is essentially a book, you know. That's all it is. But I mean, almost thinking, gosh, are people going to burn this book? I don't know. I think that the position, the sort of like anger that I've been on the receiving end thus far is people saying, well, you know, based on the title and the cover alone, this is racist towards white people. I hope that if somebody feels that way, they'll pick up a copy of the book and read at least why I think that they're wrong in that position. Because while I think racism is prejudice plus power, I think we've all got the capacity to be prejudiced, undoubtedly. But not everybody has the power to put that prejudice into action and really deeply affect people's life chances. And I suppose, like, with the backlash about the title already, before it's even out, I think that white people are not used to being named as white by people who aren't white. Because the title isn't I Hate White People or Death of the White Man. That's really not what it says. It starts with the word why, which I hope people read that as an explanation. And the title, I called it that because I wrote a blog post titled exactly the same thing about 3.5 years ago. And when I wrote that, it was not for want of trying, let's just say that. I wrote that title and that blog post after a really long time of trying really, really hard to talk to white people about race, and finding myself at a point of basically emotional exhaustion. And in that blog post, I spoke about the ways in which every time I try to raise this issue about racism in our society, it was difficult to talk about the nuances of a problem with people who didn't want to accept that a problem even existed. And it sort of went back to that point of white people feeling immediately implicated before I'd even had the opportunity to finish a sentence, and deeply offended at being called racist, even though I'd never actually called anyone in particular racist. And yeah, so it was really wasn't for want of trying. I think that people look at the title and think I hate white people or something, but what can you do? I was an English literature undergraduate. I understand that at a certain point, you know, your intent is gone and it's about everybody else's interpretations. And and that's okay. But I've tried my hardest, I think, in the book to explain that about structural racism, about prejudice, about and the differences between the two. Yeah, so I think that the title and the cover, which is really great and super duper creative, and I hope that Greg, who designed it, wins many awards. I hope that it provokes some conversation, but I hope that also people can sort of get past it and actually engage with the arguments and the ideas. I think that I've read repeatedly over the last couple of years that those of us who are interested in forwarding an anti-racist perspective are too chicken or too cowardly to have the argument in public, which I don't think is the case. And I've written 80,000 words to show that that isn't the case.
No, great. So it's, what you're kind of saying is that the criticism will probably stem from some deep guttural emotional reaction to, yeah, being called white, being called prejudice, all these type of things that we spoke about at the start as well of this interview.
Yeah, definitely. But also, yeah. Like, white is a descriptor. And I think that, you know, I'm not offended when somebody calls me black. I don't care. It's an adjective. But I think that, you know, whiteness in our society has become, is neutral. So, like, we only ever call, we only ever mention someone's race if they're not white. So, and I think that's why it's so shocking and so deeply terrifying to some white people. And somebody even messaged me saying, this is really scary. And I was like, wow, guys, like, I guess if somebody interprets it as scary, fine. But, you know, I don't know. I can't see anything particularly, like, terrifying about the title. Do you know what I mean?
It's almost like, why are you calling me white? What do you mean when you call me white, I suppose? If it's something has been neutral for such a long time. Then you don't really know how to interpret that word right now. And I guess when there's no kind of cultural interpretation of what white means, and as you say, it is just a descriptor, and that should be how we interpret it. But for now, we're kind of going, oh, is that an insult? You know, what does that even mean?
I just think that white people are very unused to being called white, but people have been referring to me as black all my life as a marker of difference, basically.
Yeah.
And I guess white people are just not used to being marked as different.
Yeah. No, it's a good point.
But what the book does and what the cover does is really completely decenter whiteness, which is centered for such a, has been centered. And fiction is a really good measure of how whiteness is centered. You know, our protagonists are always white in film and media and books. And I know that I've grown up seeing the world through white eyes. I'm a huge fiction lover. And what this book does is, it is ultimately decenter that. The cover does it, the title does it, and I think that that makes people uncomfortable.
Yeah. This has been a fantastic, it's been fantastic speaking to you, Reni. Got a lot of out of it, and I hope our listeners go out and buy your book and and come back to us and come back to you with some comments.
Thanks. I'm really interested in what people have to say, and I feel like my sort of business is done here, so you know, now it's just going to be about what people think of it. And I just kind of, I'm hoping that people are going to engage sincerely with the ideas and not get all in a tiz. Because, you know, I mean, you said before we started recording that you thought that my ideas were very new, but I take a lot of inspiration from somebody like Stuart Hall, who was writing in the 60s and the 70s, you know, and I take inspiration from people like Angela Davis, who were also working hard to completely decenter this very, very pervasive and structure of power. So I don't think it's very new at all. But one thing that I hope is that for those who it's new to, they really engage with it sincerely. So maybe I'm asking too much. I don't know.
Let's You're see. Definitely not asking too much. But yeah, thanks so much for coming on the show.
Right. Thanks for having me.
So thank you so much to Reni for coming on the show. I have to say that from my perspective, that's probably the most honest interview I've had in the short history of doing this podcast in terms of my beliefs in relation to the material that I'm discussing. And so I hope you enjoyed that. I would encourage you to go out and read the book, particularly if you're quite, well, the title in itself is antagonizing, right? Why I'm no longer talking to white people about race. But from speaking to Rennie now, you can tell that's not her intention at all. She's just trying to move the conversation along in a different way. And I'd love to hear what you think about it, whether or not it challenged you just as much as it challenged me. I'm always contactable, as you know, editor@echochamber.club. Rennie as well, she can be followed on Twitter. She's got a blog. She's very approachable. Her Twitter is @RennieRennie. And yeah, just make sure that you keep listening and contacting us. It's so great when we hear from you, whether or not that's the newsletter or the podcast, and you just give us your thoughts. So do keep listening, and I'll speak to you next time.